Yeah, thanks for invitation here, and I'm happy to give this talk, which I have slightly shifted or changed the title during the preparation of this, because this is a bit immature, perhaps, this presentation. And when we are talking about Gelechioidea, we are talking about something very huge. It's one of those biggest radiations in Lepidoptera, and likely much more larger than ever has been thought, in fact. There are at the moment about 24,000 estimated species described, and it may be that in the end we end up to something like 100,000 extant species. This is one of the most neglected group of Lepidoptera for lepidopterists, because often the adults are rather small, dull-colored, drab, non-interesting, and everything looks like each other. So you really have to be a passionate to start digging up or down into them. And in any group, you have to do lots of dissections to really recover the real diversity, and often by standard methods you only get the trivial ones. You never find the more specialized things unless you do very careful, focused, specialized collecting, and this applies to almost every Gelechioidean family, I think, with some exceptions. The family classification of Gelechioidea has been a total mess ever. There are as many classifications as there have been authors dealing with these families, or to be honest, there are much more family classification than authors, because same authors have been the habit of changing and shifting groups to one family to another, rising new families and putting down others, usually without explaining why, and nobody have been able to keep track on these things. Usually there have been about 15 to 25, 26 families recognized, but all too often only the so-called core genera, namely the nominate genus and a few around them, are rather well placed, and the rest are put where they seem to fit most or best. So few of the families have ever been really defined, and that's obviously a great problem when we are dealing with tens and tens of thousands of species. Looks like nothing happened. When I mentioned about the potential of up to 100,000 species extant, it's based on these kind of paragraphs. This is based on my forthcoming study on the Australian elachistines. There are 11 described species, and after 1 year there in field, I ended up to 150 about. And this shows that over 60 of these 150 species have been found only once, and there are only two species that forever have been found there more than 20 times. And if you make some very unscientific calculation, how many species have been found zero times, you end up to something very interesting figures. And this is not an exception, but I'm afraid this is a rule if we give the exceptions for Europe and Palearctic Russia. Many families, if not most, in most areas of the world will show similar patterns. This is another Elachistiae example from North America. It's almost the same. And we know from North America, from Jean-Francois studies, that for instance in Coleophorida and Scutridida the patterns are almost identical, and even in Palearctic region in some families they are like that. Just imagine what they are in Southern America or Africa or Oriental region. Okay, Gelechioids usually can be recognized by the long ascending labial palpi together with basally scaled hostellum. These two characters are applicable to some other families, like some pura leaves as well, or most of them, in fact. And basally scaled Ostellum is you find in some other groups as well. This is combined with a so-called tinnate type sternum too, with narrow ridge, like how to get back. End show. Okay. I'd have to do that. All right. Thanks. Yeah. All right. Narrow rod-shaped sternal rod and long narrow apodeme. This is typical tinnate type sternum too. However, in all too often you find galechioids with this kind of, I would say, tortoise seed type, bloody hell, I would say.
Use the keyboard.
Keyboard back. All right, thanks. Life is learning. Yes. And this is, I would say, this is like kind of intermediate between tinnate and tortoise seed type, because here we all again see this narrow sternal rod. But there are also things that have very broad and or none at all. So combination of this so-called tinnate type sternum 2 and these external characters usually is enough to characterize a thing to be likely a galechioid. Here are some how some pupae can look like. Those that are externally pupating typically have attachment in the... Now it... Yes, I'm just a dummy. It doesn't show very well, but they attach by a spine group here and another often here, and Elachistinae have they mimic butterflies in having this kind of silken girdle here, and this is one of the most spectacular larvae of Anatomia. Most of the larvae of galechioids are concealed feeders, so they don't look like much anything. I made an analysis of that aimed to give a hypothesis of the possible phylogenetic relationships with the galechioidea. It was based entirely on morphology, with the exception of a few larval behavior characters, mostly pupation related characters. I derived the characters from larvae, pupae and adult morphology, and ended up with a bit less than 200 morphological characters, with 240 informative character states. Now we could go back what the galechioideans are supposed to be in the tree of Lepidopteran life. They are traditionally thought to be something close to Hyponomeltoids, so-called primitive Detrusians, namely non-Apodetrusians. And this is the Christensen Skalski Bible consensus cladogram of the relationships. There have been different permutations of this general idea by different authors. I had included 13 outgroup families in my study, and that put, in fact, Galechioidea deep into Upper Detrusia. So the composition of the Galechioidea seems to be controversial. At least there is no straightforward morphological support that they would not belong to Upper Detrusia. And it seems that from both the Tree of Life project and our own ongoing project aiming at the resolving the Detrusian superfamily interrelationships seem to support this kind of placement, that they belong to Upper Detrusia really. So the tinnate type sternum 2, which is common in some species rich lineages, seem to be reversals. I ended up into this kind of family arrangement. I never suggested any formal family classification, so this is just a general idea how the taxa that Ron Hodges recognized would be organized in relationship with each other within Gelechioidea, which I found monophyletic, which was itself surprising to me. The Gelechioidea seems to be divided into two main lineages, which I call so-called Gelechid lineage. It's the upper half of this here. There are Gelechids, Cosmopterygids, Chytridae, Pterolonchidae, Monfidae, and Coleophoridae in a new expanded concept, Deoclonidae, Syringopidae, and the rest we could call Echophorid. I'm sorry of this repeated silliness. Echophorid lineage, which would include so-called unclear things that seem all to be grouped together. Lesitochirid, Autostichid, Simmochids, Holcopogonids. They seem to form one clade. I call it Autostichid family assemblage, or I'd rather like to call it Autostichidae. The only reason that I don't call it is because of the Lesitochiridae, which is well-established family name published in the same paper as Autostichidae. I won't be the one to decide which is to be preferred, at least based on this, just this analysis. Xylorhynchids came out as monophyletic group, not very well supported. You don't need much change in the data set, probably just a few more larvae present and they would group together with this Autostichid assemblage. Echophoridae sensu stricto came out nicely. It included the whole Australian huge radiation with thousands of species, although I didn't include thousands of species in the analysis, but just four of them, but it's more than nothing. Amphisbatidae sensu old world is something else than Amphisbatidae sensu new world. Amphisbatidae sensu new world are in fact part of Elachistidae sensu lato. This is based on a few years ago published paper, and unfortunately much has not happened since based on my work. I know that there is molecular work going on, I hope very fast, in new world, and I'm anxiously waiting for the results of that. But one change I can now say that to the Amphisbatidae, one family from Tineoids, namely Lipusidae, they are typical Amphisbatids. The literature has repeated now 200 years that they have reduced maxilla, but in fact they have quite well developed maxilla with a scaled base, and their every adult character points to Amphisbatidae, and all the immature characters also. And now we have also molecular evidence that supports their placement in Amphisbatidae. So Lipusa is no more a problem of Don Davis, but a problem of myself now. Here I now show a bit details. The Coleophorid assemblage, or Coleophoridae, however you call it, would include, now it's going just wrong way all the time because I do wrong way things. I don't know this. I pronounce it Calopeta. It might be Xylopoeiaeta, Tinae, as basal, and very paraphyletic or polyphyletic Batrachydridae, which seems to be an assemblage of various things. Statmopodidae or Statmopodids are included in this clade, the core Batrachydras and Coleophora. Here in the end, I have lost the cursor, the arrow, so I can't, and I don't dare to do anything to get it back. But what we learn from this is that Batrachydra is a natural entity, and in the southern hemisphere we have lots of taxa that will be very helpful in revealing the relationship of these, because Statmopodids have been thought to be rather isolated group of Echophoridae. But in fact there occurs a full transformation series within Australian fauna from typical primitive Batrachydras to these Statmopodids. So I'm rather convinced that they are they belong here, in fact. Elachisti de sensu lato is about the same as elachisti de sensu mine, 83. Though here are some odd taxa like telecrucis at the moment included. I believe it's an artifact because of lacking data of images. Otherwise, it seems that Hypercalliani or Hypertrophine, I don't know at the moment which is the correct name, is not a family occurring only in Australasian region, but it's worldwide distributed group. For instance, in North America we have species such as Machimia tentoriferella, it belongs here. Depressarine sensu stricto, namely sensu northern hemisphere, et mine. I got the Orofiani tribe here, and then now I saw a poster yesterday where it seems to be excluded, which is very natural because I included it based on thoracic and larval characters, and they are excluded in a dataset where these character sets are excluded, so nobody knows. Let's wait for more comprehensive data of dealing with the whole this assemblage, which desperately requires much more denser taxon sampling. And these are the subfamilies or families or whatever they are. To get a bit closer back to the today's topic, namely the imagers, I plotted to this phylogeny of the larval feeding habits. Gelechioides is one of those suprafamilies where there are both herbivores and saprophagos or fungivorous or detritivorous taxa. To see the possible evolutionary pattern of these different feeding strategies, we see that we can't see which is the basal thing, because outgroups that I included, they are all feeding on green plants. So maybe it is the ancestral form, and the whole Gelechid lineage is with some derived things in cosmopterygids are herbivorous. And then the saprophagous groups tend to be in the ecophorid assemblage. There are many fungus feeders or dead litter feeders and such things. But here again, there are also green plant feeders. And so the only conclusion we can say that the evolutionary history is not straightforward, but that whatever has happened, there must have been lots of reversals. And here, to go further detail to the autostichid and xyloreptid assemblages, we see that there have been lots of shifts. The missing data is the worst problem here, namely the imagers are not well known, or if they are known, they are not known to me, and I don't know where to hunt them. But in any case, the pattern looks like rather mosaic kind, that it's not big deal for taxa to shift from one host substrate to another kind in these groups. And in some groups like blastobasids, which were included in Xyloryctidae sensu stricto, by the way, a result that was supported by John Wenzel and Sibyl Buchheli's paper of molecular data as well, by the way. Here it's difficult to delimit where they are detritivores and when they are herbivores, because several species feed on dry plant material, and what it is then in the sense of coding, I don't know. There can be coding errors or artificial coding here as well. Another aspect is the occurrence of leaf miners within Gelechioidea. If we look at the Hodges phylogeny that was published in the Handbook of Zoology, it would require that there were, I think, 11 independent occurrences of shifting to leaf mining habit. So, and with that I mean that at least the first instar larvae are at first leaf mining. They may then come out and to become external feeders. In any case, I think that leaf mining is rather specialized character requiring lots of adaptations. And this kind of family classification or phylogeny would suggest only two independent occurrences of leaf mining within Gilechioidea. Almost the whole Gilechi lineage include taxa. Not all of them are. And here in Pterolonchidae, the species of which the life history is known, they are in fact stem borer or root borers, so it's not far from being a leaf miner, I think. So it's not that big deal. In Gilechids, I think that many larvae are leaf miners in first instar, but not necessarily all. I don't really know. But let's continue a bit to a bit different topic, which points more to the future than past, which I feel this that I am now shown is to me a bit past at the moment. On larva characters, usually the ketotaxy is considered essential, but it's not an easy thing. Namely, it's largely based on presence and absence of setae, and they are, I don't know how significant these kind of characters after all are, and the relative position of setae. Let's see, a group of three setae, are they in row, horizontal row, in oblique row, or forming a triangle? There are three points, and any of them can be shifting and causing the pattern to be different. And so different patterns lead to obviously similar patterns. And to me, this is a problem and reduces the usefulness of these kind of characters. For instance, in my study, I used over 30 such characters on which I don't feel very confident myself. And in our group, we are now having a sub-project which uses geometric morphometrics to estimate the essence of the variation. By this methodology, and I'm not going into details of it, we can get grab on what really varies and how much. And that means that we may be able to find the things that really are constant or more constant, and separate them from those variable things that are not useful, especially in higher levels of classifications. So we are hunting for such ketotaxy characters that could be used for character coding or in developing phylogenies. And I will skip this picture because honestly, I don't understand of the content myself. I just got it last minute. Here is some results we are getting from Hanne Ruotsalainen, and okay, I include it. It looks nice. and a bit simple things. They made some noctuid species. Several mothers lay eggs, and then they reared the larvae and spotted how many anomalies they found in the offspring of each, and quite often they are missing setae or other things. And like microcetae or pores could every now and then be formed as true setae on both sides of the larva, and so if you have just a few or one larva, you can be misled quite drastically because such changes are thought very highly significant in phylogenies. And offspring of different females of same species often were statistically quite different. And it's a bit dangerous, I think. So, the existence of both qualitative and quantitative variation in ketotaxy should be kept brightly in mind when scoring morphological characters, and that's more or less the message, that which is silly and trivial, but almost often in practice almost always forgotten, unfortunately. Thank you, everybody. Excuse me.
Where does Lipusa fit in that mess up there? Lipusa.
Lipusa. What did you... I'm sorry, what did...
Y-U-S-A.
They are not... there are no species in USA, as far as I know. No, I haven't found in U.S. galecioid either yet. It may be hidden somewhere, but it's not present in the Hodges Ecophoride book, which is the most likely source to find it.